All right, let's go back to the book together. Lamentations chapter 1. Lamentations chapter 1. I think that all of us understand the idea that suffering is a very isolating thing to go through. Because even if you do have God's people surrounding you, helping you, giving you cards, fixing you food, hugging you, giving you as much encouragement as they possibly can, there's only so much that they can do. They can't actually fix, often, the original problem that you're suffering through. It's nice to have empathy, but often that's not a final solution. We all understand that, but that's still nevertheless very lonely for the one who is going through that suffering. You know, I hate how helpless I often feel in hospital rooms or when I go to funerals. Even if I'm the one doing the funeral, preaching the funeral, there's not enough to say that I can do or speak to fix the problem that somebody is going through. How often I have wished that I had the miraculous ability to touch somebody and heal their disease, or to touch somebody's corpse and resurrect them from the grave. I wish, how often I've wished that I could do that. That we had these gifts that we see in the first century that the Christians were exercising there, but that we don't have anymore. So whether we are the people who are hurting, or we're the people who are trying to comfort other people who are hurting, I think all of us long for somebody to fix it. Really fix it. Not to try to slap band-aids on it or try to, you know, help the hurt in some kind of superficial way, but to really get down into the wound and make it all right. That is what this book cries out for. Let's read this together before we say anything else about it. Let's go to chapter 1 and let's just read chapter 1 and spend the rest of our time in this text together. Lamentations 1, verse 1. How lonely sits the city that was full of people. How like a widow she has become. She who was great among the nations. She who was a princess among the provinces has become a slave. She weeps bitterly in the night with tears on her cheeks. Among all her lovers, she has none to comfort her. All her friends have dealt treacherously with her. They've become her enemies. Judah has gone into exile because of affliction and hard servitude. She dwells now among the nations but finds no resting place. Her pursuers have all overtaken her in the midst of her distress. The roads to Zion mourn, for none come to the festival. All her gates are desolate. Her priests groan. Her virgins have been afflicted, and she herself suffers bitterly. Her foes have become the head. Her enemies prosper because the Lord has afflicted her for the multitude of her transgressions. Her children have gone away, captives before the foe. From the daughter of Zion, all her majesty has departed. Her princes have become like deer that find no pasture. They fled without strength before the pursuer. Jerusalem remembers in the days of her affliction and wandering all the precious things that were hers from days of old, when her people fell into the hand of the foe and there was none to help her. Her foes gloated over her. They mocked at her downfall. Jerusalem sinned grievously. Therefore she became filthy. All who honored her despise her, for they've seen her nakedness. She herself groans and turns her face away. Her uncleanness was in her skirts. She took no thought of her future, therefore her fall is terrible. She has no comforter. O Lord, behold my affliction. For the enemy has triumphed. The enemy has stretched out his hands over all her precious things. For she has seen the nations enter her sanctuary, those whom you forbade to enter your congregation. All her people groan as they search for bread. They trade their treasures for food to revive their strength. Look, O Lord, and see, for I'm despised. Is it nothing to you, all you who pass by? Look and see if there is any sorrow like my sorrow, which is brought upon me, which the Lord inflicted on the day of his fierce anger. From on high he sent fire, into my bones he made it descend. He spread a net for my feet, he turned me back, he's left me stunned, faint, all the day long. My transgressions were bound into a yoke. By his hands they were fastened together, they were set upon my neck, he caused my strength to fail. The Lord gave me into the hands of those whom I cannot withstand. The Lord rejected all my mighty men in my midst. He summons an assembly against me to crush my young men. The Lord has trodden as in a winepress the virgin daughter of Judah. For these things I weep. My eyes flow with tears. For a comforter is far from me, one to revive my spirit. My children are desolate, for the enemy has prevailed. Zion stretches out her hands, but there is none to comfort her. The Lord has commanded against Jacob that his neighbors should be his foes. Jerusalem has become a filthy thing among them. The Lord is in the right. For I have rebelled against his word. But hear, all you peoples, and see my suffering. My young women and my young men have gone into captivity. I called to my lovers, but they deceived me. My priests and elders perished in the city while they sought food to revive their strength. Look, O Lord, for I am in distress. My stomach churns. My heart is wrung within me because I've been very rebellious. In the street, the sword breathes. In the house, it is like death. They heard my groaning, yet there is no one to comfort me. All my enemies have heard of my trouble. They are glad that you've done it. You brought the day you announced. Now let them be as I am. Let all their evil doing come before you, and deal with them as you have dealt with me because of all my transgressions. For my groans are many, and my heart is faint. You may have picked this up as we read through this chapter, this heart-wrenching chapter together. But over and over throughout this, he talks about how there is no comforter. There's no comfort. There's no comfort. And so that's the structure that I'd like to use to work through this chapter with you. Beginning in verse 2, this is the first time that you see this being said by this writer, whoever he is. Look at verse 2 again. She weeps bitterly in the night with tears on her cheeks among all her lovers. She has none to comfort her. All her friends have dealt treacherously with her. They become her enemies. Notice that the she in verse 1 goes back to, or the verse 2 goes back to verse 1 when it talks about this widow, when it talks about this princess among the provinces has now become a slave. This widow, this princess is pictured as the city of Jerusalem, being portrayed as this person, this she who is now going through this suffering. She once ruled in security and greatness and power, and now she is in the dust. Now she is moaning and groaning, and there is no one to help her. In verse 2, did you notice how she used to have lovers, and she used to have friends? And just like the Proverbs friends that we were talking about this morning in class, now that she is abased, where are they now? They've vanished into the woodwork. They're no longer there. She has no one left. You remember in the days of the kings how great Jerusalem was? Do you remember in Solomon's time when the Queen of Sheba came with her questions and her gold and her spices, and she came into the city and she looked at the way that the officials were seated in the court and their clothes and the banquet feast that was set for Solomon and his people? She looked at all of that splendor, and the text in Kings says there was no more breath in her body. Well, now, for God's people, there's no more breath in their body because of what they have done to God. They have no one to comfort them anymore. Verse 9, you see this word being used again. Look at verse 9. Her uncleanness was in her skirts. She took no thought of her future. Therefore, her fall is terrible. She has no, here it is again, no comforter. O Lord, behold my affliction, for the enemy has triumphed. You know, when you read the books of the kings, you look at what the Israelites did as they came into the land, as they grew secure and fat and prosperous in the promised land. What did they do with that? They turned their position toward idolatry. They worshipped Baal and nasty gods like Baal, who demanded child worship and also demanded sexual practices from its worshipers. They did those things, and so they were defiled in so many different kinds of ways. And so when you read the prophets, Amos and Ezekiel and Jeremiah, all these guys, they continually railed against, don't give yourselves in sexual perverted ways to people who worship idols. The people of God are to be holy, set apart from that kind of thing. But up till the day that this city fell, they wallowed in this sexual perversity. And there are plenty of ways, even today, that sexual immorality clings to the skirts of Americans. And we, as the people of God, living in this sex-saturated land, would do well to remember passages like this, where God speaks against this in no uncertain terms, about how He feels, and about what happens when the people of God go through this. They will end up alone with no comforter. But verse 9, he is calling out, as he does three times in this chapter, he's calling out to God at the end of this verse, O Lord, behold my affliction. He does that in verse 11 and again in verse 20. But he feels this separation now. In verse 16, look at what he says there again as he uses this idea. Verse 16, for these things I weep, my eyes flow with tears. For a comforter is far from me, one to revive my spirit. My children are desolate because the enemy has prevailed. Did you notice the shift in the language that's being used here? So up until this point, the chapter has been talking about she, her. She over there is going through this suffering, Zion, but now he's taking on the language of this poor widow, this princess who's now in the dust, and he is using her voice, and instead of she, it's now for these things, I weep, my eyes flow with tears. Her pain is his pain. And we'll talk about that when we get to the application part of this and the core thoughts that we need to kind of come back to when we read a chapter that is as devastating as this one is. But this so reminds me of New Testament passages like 1 Corinthians 12, where Paul says, the body of Jesus' people is one connected unit. You know, body parts are not living in disconnected worlds from each other. They're all squashed on top of each other. You know, the lungs are not like out here. That would really look weird if we had body parts just loosely connected to us and not encased within one frame. And that might make like doctors' jobs easier. But they're like, well, it's just right out here. We can just operate there. But, you know, there's no personal space. There's no personal space when it comes to the members of the body. And that's the image that gets used by the Apostle Paul to say, that's who we are. When one member suffers, all the members suffer with it, because we're all right there. We're all right there with each other. At least we should be. But that's the case here. As he takes on the voice of his fellow Israelites and the devastation that they are encountering. In the next verse, look at the next verse. He says it again, and he's going to say it again after that. Verse 17, Zion stretches out her hands, but there's none to comfort her. The Lord has commanded against Jacob that his neighbors should be his foes. Jerusalem has become a filthy thing among them. It's not like this widow is not answering her phone calls and just holing up in her house and ignoring everybody else in the world. She's saying, help me. I need assistance. I'm dying here. I'm desolate. I'm in the dust. But her begging is going unanswered. You know, when you look at what happened to Judah, as the Babylonians came closer and closer and closer, Judah did this, not to God. They did this to Egypt. And Egypt said, oh yeah, yeah, I'm gonna be there for you. Send an army there to help you out there. And the army left, and then the army went back home. And Babylon came, and they destroyed Judah, because Judah stretched out in the wrong direction. And so because of that, there is no comfort for her. And all her enemies became her neighbors, as he says in this verse. We're even told in the prophet Obadiah that there were Edomites who stood at the crossroads of the exits of Judah. And the Edomite soldiers stood there and cut off the fleeing Judeans as they tried to cross over the border into safety, away from Babylon, there in Jerusalem. There was no safe place to go. No comfort. No safety. No security that they once possessed that they no longer have, because they're not going to God. Verse 21, the last time he uses this word is toward the end of this chapter. Notice this again, verse 21. They heard my groaning, talking about people around them. Yet there's no one to comfort me. All my enemies have heard of my trouble, and they are glad that you've done it. You brought the day you announced. Now let them be as I am. You ever notice how when you go through one kind of suffering, one kind of pain, sometimes there's a whole bunch of other pains that say, yeah, we want in on that too, and come through your door as well. That's the case here. They have the pain of Babylon, which is pain enough by itself, but then they've also got the pain of the enemies around them who are gloating, who are so happy to see Jerusalem fall. They hated that city. They hated God's people. They hated that temple on the hill that was a beacon of light saying, we're the people of God. They couldn't wait to see that fall. And don't we understand that? In our own lives, when you have something that hurts you, sometimes a whole bunch of stuff follows it. That's what they're encountering here. So Judah, Jerusalem, feels absolutely lonely and helpless before this barrage of problems and pains. So what do we do about this? I think it's really important when we read a passage like this, and when we go through pain, especially really intense pain in our lives, that we come back to and rest ourselves on thoughts that can anchor us to reality of what is true. To give you a quote from the book that I mentioned in the first lesson by Mark Vrogoff, Dark Clouds, Deep Mercy, he says this, in all that we feel and all the questions we have, there comes a point where we must call to mind what we know to be true. What we know to be true. And so when you're caught up, and when I'm caught up in a swirling vortex of emotions and events, and I've got to make sense of this, and I've got to get through my day, and I've got to get through my week, and I don't know what this all means and how to deal with it, what do we come back to? What do we know to be true? Well, he does this in this chapter. Did you notice that? In all of this, there's no comfort. There's no peace. He comes back to and he rests in some thoughts. Verse 18 is one of those thoughts. And he flat out says that. This is a direct quote, at least from the ESV translation, where he just says, as he thinks about this mess, the Lord is in the right. This is the trust stage. In the first lesson, we talked about the various stages of how to biblically go through grief. Verse 18 is an example of the peak of that, where he just looks at God with all of his questions and says, you know what? I don't know how this all works, but you're God. You're the maker. You're the sustainer. You're the one that we serve and worship. You are in the right. It was beyond belief that this happened to the people. And don't you go through situations where the unthinkable happens to you? Where you look at the event, you look at what happened, And sometimes it was completely outside of your control. Sometimes, in this case, he's talking about his sins. He's talking about things that he did wrong, that the people have done wrong. Sometimes things happen to us we cannot control in the least. And we go, why did God allow that to happen? We got to come back to this idea when we go through that thought process. The Lord is in the right. In fact, I would say that the book of 1 Kings and 2 Kings are in the Bible because the Israelites asked this question of how in the world could this have happened? Why did God allow the Babylonians to come and wipe out his sanctuary and all of us? That book answers that question. And so when you and I face unthinkable situations, we need to realize that we cannot even see the next move on the chessboard. We don't know what the next 5 minutes, what the next day, what the next month looks like, but God sees in our lives and in nations and in the scope of history, he sees 1,000 moves ahead and behind on the chessboard of life. He knows what is best, even if I don't understand how this could possibly be the will of God. It's unfair. That's what it feels like. We'll talk about that more in a second. But this is what he comes back to. It's what we need to come back to as well. And then what he also keeps coming back to in this chapter, and you may have noticed that this is a really big theme in this chapter, is sin is the real problem. He says that, and so we're not going to read all of these verses again, but just to remind us, verse 5, toward the beginning of the chapter, notice how he says, okay, her foes have become the head, her enemies prosper because the Lord has afflicted her. The Lord has come down on us. Why? Well, here's why. For the multitude of her transgressions, her children have gone away captives before the foe. Notice what he doesn't say about the source of everybody's pain. He doesn't say, well, you know what? We're in this mess because Babylon was more equipped than our soldiers were. They had better generals than our generals. They had a better king than our king. And, oh, they had food. You know, we didn't have any food. So, for crying out loud, yes, we fell. That's not what he says. That's not why they're going into captivity. He doesn't say things along the lines of, you know, God has just turned against us because he's a mean God. He has just decided that we are now his enemies. No, he doesn't say any of that. He says, we have transgressed his will. And because of that, he has brought this against us. Sin is identified as the real cause of this suffering. The fact that you and I go through all kinds of hurt in our lives ultimately has a root in what has happened in the cosmic fracturing of the universe when sin came into the world in Genesis 3. That's been preached before by me and by others, and I want to say it again in a slightly different way. My hurt, your hurt, is not because of the meanness of God. It is because of the human rebellion that all of us have participated in. At some time in our lives, all of us have raised our pitiful little fists and said, I know how to live my life better than you know how to direct mine. Thank you very much, God. I'm going to do things my way. And this is what happens to us in our lives when we do that. Human sin causes pain. And that's not to say, and I'm quick to clarify this, that's not to say that every painful event in your life is because of something you have done wrong or that somebody else necessarily has done wrong, but the fact that we have sinned and that all of us have is the cause, the real cause of all the problems that we face here. And so when you and I are tempted to think, I don't deserve this, I don't deserve this, we're probably forgetting the fact at least I'm speaking for myself, that I don't deserve to draw breath. I don't deserve to wake up in the morning with the good health that I have and go about my day. As painful as that day might be sometimes, what we deserve, what I deserve, is for God to pull the plug on my life. What I did not deserve is for the Son of God to come down here to this painful world and to offer His own blood as a sacrifice to cover my sins. That's what I don't deserve. But that's what He gave. Sin is the real problem. And also, if you look back at verse 4, it's kind of a representative verse. I think it's interesting that he comes back to the idea that my pain is not the only pain there is. Look at verse 4 again. The roads to Zion mourn, none come to the festival. All her gates are desolate, her priests groan, her virgins have been afflicted, and she herself suffers bitterly. He's looking around. See that? He's not just looking at himself. Here, God, here's what I am going through. Pain can be so isolating and self-focusing sometimes, can't it? God, I want to talk to you about my suffering. And when we do that, sometimes we close our eyes and ears off to the pain that other people are going through as well. We're not the only ones. If sin in our lives has broken the world and all of us are sinners, all of us are going to be going through pain at some point, at different times, in different ways. And we need to be open to that. That our sin hasn't just affected ourselves. It's affected our communities. It's affected our nation that we're living in. It's affected other nations in the world. It's affected all human life. Not just our own. God calls us not to just simply shake our heads at the people in the world. Yeah, it's an evil place out there. It's yucky. It's full of terrible people. God calls us to notice the pain of those terrible people so that we can have compassion on it, so that we can pray for it. And for them, if you've got a coworker who suffers with alcoholism or some kind of substance abuse or some kind of anger issues or some kind of other spiritual problem, it's easy, like we talked about this morning, to just say, "Oh, I'm thankful I'm not you," in our heads. We never say that, of course. And then just to take a step back, it's much harder, but it's much more closely aligned with the heart of God to come beside that person and say, "Hey, tell me about your life story. What's going on with you? I can see kind of on the outside this is going on, but what's your story?" And then to pray with that person and to say, "Hey, let's sit down and read Jesus together. Open up the book of Mark with me. Let's go." Because only He is the one that can fix this. God is our only true comforter. And you see this in so many different passages in the Bible. These are just a representation of this idea. Go to Isaiah 40 with me. We're going to read these passages and then we'll offer the invitation. Isaiah chapter 40 in verses 1 and 2. This is a neat part of the book of Isaiah because we're shifting focus in the language. Most of the first part of Isaiah is pretty rough because this is before Judah has been destroyed. The people are rotten to the core, and Isaiah is calling out again and again about that. And we get a hint in the one story section of Isaiah that Judah's not going to make it. They are going to be destroyed by Babylon. But there's a note of comfort in verse 40, or chapter 40, verse 1 and 2, where God says, "Comfort, comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem." This is even before the city's destroyed. "And cry to her that her warfare is ended, that her iniquity is pardoned, and that she has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins." God is not just going to sweep everything under the rug. He is going to deal with her sins, but He's going to deal with it in such a way that He can pour out His blessings on his people in the latter days, in the time of Jesus. That's what this is looking forward to, because verse 3 picks up and it's John the Baptist. It's the voice crying out in the wilderness, preparing the way of the Lord, making his path straight. The king is coming. He's on his way and he's going to deal with this junk and he's going to restore it and make it beautiful. That's Isaiah. 2 Corinthians 1 is the passage that Bradford read for us several minutes ago, where Paul is opening up to a church that didn't really like him very much about what was going on in his life. And he says, I'm just going to read this again, 2 Corinthians chapter 1, 3 through 7. Paul, this is one of the most vulnerable moments you ever see in the writings of Paul in this book. And he just opens this up and says, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies and God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our affliction, so that we may be able to comfort those who are in any affliction with the comfort with which we ourselves are comforted by God." You know just how saturated this word is in this section? "For as we share abundantly in Christ's suffering, so through Christ we share abundantly in comfort too. If we're afflicted, it's for your comfort and salvation. If we are comforted, it's for your comfort, which you experience when you patiently endure the same sufferings that we suffer. Our hope for you is unshaken, for we know that as you share in our sufferings, you will also share in our comfort." How many different times can you say the same thing? But whenever you see passages in the Bible like that, our antenna is supposed to go up, say, oh, this is uber important. Because he's saying it over and over. God is a God of comfort. And so when Lamentation says over and over and over, "I have no comfort," we're supposed to hyperlink in our minds to passages like this to say, no, there is some comfort. When, and only when, you turn to the source of it. And finally, 2 Thessalonians 2, 16 through 17. 2 Thessalonians 2, 16 and 17. Paul is talking about what he desires for these new Christians who've been baptized just recently before this. And he says, "Now may our Lord Jesus Christ himself and God our Father, who loved us and gave us eternal comfort and good hope through grace, comfort your hearts and establish them in every good work and word." The invitation that is extended to all of us this morning is for us to turn to our true comforter, is to take the pain and even to use a strong word that probably accurately describes the way some of us have to deal with our days, anguish, to take all of that to the one who can truly fix it. Look for encouragement in your fellow Christians. Look for comfort in your God. You need to obey the gospel. You need to come back to it this morning. Let us know how we can help, how we can lead you to this comfort that's not in us, but is in the one who made us and saves us. I just gotta stand up and we sing the invitation song.